Okay, it's 11:30, so we're going to begin the panel. I'm going to introduce the panelists very, very briefly, and then they'll reintroduce themselves and amplify on my introduction and point out the things that I get wrong, probably. But I'm going to start with Wendy, so wave your hand, Wendy. So Wendy Corsi Staub is the New York Times best-selling Edgar Mary Higgins Clark Award-nominated suspense novelist of nearly 80 novels, and she's the winner of the RWA Rita Award, and numerous other awards. She's writing a trilogy, and the book in the trilogy that I read is Sleepwalker. The next two are Shadow Killer, and what's the next one?
Shadow Killer, and Night Watcher was the first.
Night Watcher is the one I read.
And I actually remembered. I want applause for that to pick these up this morning. Such a late night in the bar.
Right. Okay, and Meredith Anthony is next to me. She has short stories in Ellery Queen magazine and the Akashic Noir series, which is actually a Brooklyn publisher, right?
Akashic.
Her story is in Philadelphia Noir. She's also written for film and TV, and her work has appeared in Mad Magazine and Women's and Women's Humor Quarterly, Hysteria, which I've never run across. And she's
now
the
author.
I'm sorry?
Now defunct.
Oh, now
there
defunct.
There is no Women's Humor anymore.
And she's the author of Lady Killer, written with Larry Light, her husband, who is on a panel down the street here a little ways, right as we speak. I don't know how they worked that out. Lawrence Kelter, you'll probably figure out who he is Brooklyn born and raised and now lives in Long Island. He's the author of a dozen or so books, including the best-selling Stephanie Chalice. How could I miss that? Stephanie Chalice. It's spelt like chalice, so if you were ever an altar boy, it's easy to confuse it. But he's the author of the Stephanie Chalice mystery series, Don't Close Your Eyes, Ransom Beach, most recently The Brain Vault, which is the book that I read, and Honored Dead, which is hard to pronounce. I don't know if you've tried that, which is coming out right as we speak, or is it out?
It just hit. Just released on the Internet this week.
All right. And next is Katja. Katja Leaf is the USA Today and international best-selling author of several novels, including the Karen Schaefer thriller series. The most recent installment is Vanishing Girls, and that's the one that I read and that I'll probably ask questions about. And then there's another one coming out in March, The Money Kill, part
that's
of that
really
same
good
series. Wendy, I'll come back and talk about the series and when those books, because I have some specific questions about that trilogy. I'm Con Lehane. I have a three-book series with a New York City bartender as a protagonist, and I have a new series, I hope, starting with a book that has a New York City librarian as the protagonist. And I'm here to sort of keep track of things and protect people from the authors here who created amazing amounts of murder and mayhem in the few books that I've read. So the title of the panel is Murder in the City That Never Sleeps. And we all know this is a reference to the Big Apple, Fun City, Gotham, the Baghdad on the Hudson, or as we like to call it, New York, the greatest city in the world. And I mean, no disrespect to wherever anyone else might hail from. In 2003, Lawrence Block wrote or published The Small Town, was the name of the book, and it was a book about New York City. And his contention was that New York is really a series of small towns, that everybody has his or her own New York. And I think that's true of our panelists. So I'm going to begin by asking each of them to talk about their New York, and more specifically the New York in the book that I mentioned, that I'm familiar with. So we can start. How about we start with Meredith, and we can talk about the deuce. Do folks know what the deuce is? Is that you? So we have a New Yorker in the crowd.
42nd Street. 42nd Street. Known as the deuce. Yeah. It isn't really. We made that up. But it sounds like a
Make sure you're speaking into the mic.
Yeah.
Or you can bend it down, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote about 42nd Street. I moved to New York right after the summer of Sam. So serial killing was definitely in the air and on everybody's mind. And I had a great job for the mayor's film office, helping people make movies. And part of my brief was to try to get producers to and executive studio people to actually buy property in New York and convert it to studio space. And we opened the Astoria Studios, Silver Cup, you know, a bunch of places that are a big deal today. But one of the things I had to do was show properties. And many of the properties were derelict peep show places along 42nd Street. So I would prance in there with these Hollywood people and try to ignore the sticky floors and the fact that the rooms were cut up into very tiny cubicles, and say, but it's load-bearing, you know, you could really, and look at the ceilings. So I got to know the deuce in a kind of an interesting way. And Larry and I wrote a short film, which is now on YouTube, by the way. I just finally put it on YouTube. Yeah, 13 Minutes of Terror. Yeah, look for it under my name. It's also called Lady Killer, and it bears some resemblance to some of the part of the book. But anyhow, that's that became my New York.
Yeah, what was this? What year was the Summer of Sam?
Summer of Sam was 76, 77. I think I moved there in 78 to 9.
Times Square is very different.
Very different. And Lady Killer is actually a historical novel. It's set in 1991, before the gentrification.
Yeah, that's pretty clear. We can just go down the...
And I want to add before I speak about my part of New York, that in the early 90s, I had a job and working for the outfit called the New 42nd Street that dealt with the old, historic theaters on that block, right? And I would show the theaters, right? So you were showing the peep show palaces, and I was showing the theaters. Mine were I think my tours were more spookily romantic, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, I took Meredith Monk in there and gave her a tour of the theaters, and if journalists were writing about it, I would take them. And it was great. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. We probably passed.
Walking around. The live theaters?
The historic theaters, there are seven or eight of them, like the New Victory and the Empire. And
then
all
the movie palaces.
They were being restored, to some extent repurposed and stuff like that. So now it's a mini Disney World over there.
Now your New York is the city of churches, the borough of churches.
Oh, let's not get carried away.
Right. So my New York is Brooklyn, New York, where I moved right after college, thinking it was going to be yet another one of my six-month pit stops, and I stayed 30 years and bought a house and raised a family, and am raising a family there. And when I moved out there, it was because the rent was cheap, and I was an aspiring writer, and I could work part time and afford a duplex in a brownstone with my sister, an aspiring artist. And over the decades that I have lived there, it's become extremely gentrified. Because I've been there so long and have really grown to love it. And have grown to know it kind of so intricately and understand the layers. And I don't fully understand the layers. I think it would take probably a few generations of a family to live there. But there are so many Brooklyns in my small community. It really is a small town where I live. We know each other. The neighbors know each other. We know the shopkeepers. And what I did in my book that was touch on these kind of two cities, and you find this all over New York, that kind of rub uncomfortably up against each other, which have a lot to do with socioeconomic and racial differences and conflicts. You can be walking down a street, a $3 million brownstones turn the corner, and all of a sudden you're in a very scary part of the city. So I rub those two parts right up against each other. My book opens with my series protagonist, Karen Schaefer, in the midnight or so, walking, taking this walk and taking a turn, just a few blocks from where she lives, but she had never been there. And it's a creepy, eerie, and scary journey for her. But she's okay because she's pretty tough. So
so your book is Prospect Heights, right?
Borham Hill.
Oh, Borham Hill.
Borham Hill,
which
yeah.
Which is pretty gentrified now.
It is.
And they now have a new basketball team in Brooklyn?
Yeah.
The Brooklyn Nets?
I was just telling Meredith, that's about five blocks from my house. Really controversial. I was against it. But it's like a big, ugly spaceship that they plopped down in the wrong spot. So...
A friend of mine used to live on Dean Street in
East. That's where I live.
Oh, is that right?
Yep.
Where the Daily News building used to be?
That's farther down, but that's closer to the Nets.
Right. His has his old apartment. It's right in the ballpark, not the ballpark, the stadium.
Oh, so, really? Ooh, eminent domain.
I should have mentioned also, Katya teaches fiction writing at the New School. How many of you have been in New York? How many of you are from New York? What I was wondering is, my next question was, how many have been in Brooklyn? Oh, all right. So,
awesome.
What about the Bronx? The Staten Island?
Yeah, that's right.
All right, what did I forget? Queens, sorry.
Queens.
Sorry, Lisa. Okay, Wendy?
Yeah, I grew up in a small town about 3 hours north of here on Lake Erie. I'm from Western New York, but I went on a school trip to New York City when I was 12 years old. Couldn't believe my parents let me go, and because no one had ever done anything like that. I was very sheltered. The oldest kid in a big Roman Catholic family in Western New York. No one ever left. And when I got to Times Square and stepped off the bus, I thought, I'm going to live here someday, and I'm going to be a writer. I knew I was going to be a writer, and I thought that was where you should go to be a writer. So they made me go to college. I didn't want to go to college. I just wanted to go. And the second I graduated college, I moved the next day to New York, and my husband is here. He's from New York, and it's been home ever since. And the first time I wrote about New York was I co-authored a series of mystery novels with Ed Koch back in the 90s, and he had been the mayor of New York. Murder on Broadway, Murder on 34th Street. It was fun. So it was, did you? Oh, he's a great guy. He was a lot of fun. So that was my first visitation of New York in my fiction. But ever since, I've written quite a few novels set there. My own personal New York has gone from being New York City proper to Westchester County, where I live now. I live in a suburb in northern Westchester. So bedroom community, nothing bad ever happens there. People don't lock the doors. You know, I like the idea of murder coming across your threshold where you feel safest. So that's what I write about now. But this trilogy, Night Watchers, the first book, this was born right in the wake of the September 11th terror attacks, because, you know, we were there, I was watching the local news in the days immediately following, and I heard three things that triggered that what if in my writer brain. One was that the crime statistics had dropped so drastically in those days immediately following, and it was a good thing because the police, obviously the city was in chaos, communications were in chaos, and it occurred to me if there were a major crime, investigating that crime would have been just extremely difficult. All bets would be off. Lower Manhattan was also basically a ghost town, so I thought you could isolate a heroine there. No communication, cut off from the rest of the world. People couldn't cross the barricades unless they could unless they lived there, and most people who lived there didn't stay. But if she had nowhere else to go, she'd be basically a sitting duck. Another thing I heard on the news, the second thing, was that people who were sort of teetering on the edge of mental illness or violence, a catastrophic event like that, witnessing something like that, could really be detrimental and push you over the edge. And I thought, well, what if, you know? The third thing is the big, big twist. There's a bombshell at the end of book two, and I won't tell you what it is, but I also heard that in those days following. But I knew it was too raw to write about at the time, so I waited about a decade. I waited 10 years. And the first book, Night Watcher, opens on September 10th, 2001 in Manhattan, and we meet characters and events begin to spiral. 9/11 is a backdrop. It's a psychological domestic suspense novel. It's a serial killer operating in the city in the immediate aftermath and the chaos. And so that was the premise for the first book. The second book picks up 10 years later in the suburbs, and there's a copycat. The killer has confessed. The killer is dead in prison, and suddenly the Night Watcher seems to be back and in the suburbs and on the anniversary of the events. So
the rest of the trilogy is outside of the city. It's in the
In and out of the city. I always go back and forth because even just living in Westchester, you know, I'm in and out of the city all the time. You know, it's accessible. I feel like, you know.
I think it's interesting that the story moved to the suburbs.
It moved to the suburbs as the heroine grew up, because now she's living her suburban dream. And I always think domestic, you know, she's married with kids, and now there's more at stake.
Okay, and Larry, not Brooklyn for this book, but Manhattan for the most part, and Long Island and Queens, including the Robert Graff Causeway, as I recollect.
That's right.
Which very few. And does anyone know the Robert Graff Causeway?
No.
Yeah, I didn't. I never heard of it. But go ahead. You're in New York.
I can enlighten you, but you read the book already.
I'm sorry?
I could enlighten you, but you've already read the book. You know where it is.
Yeah, make sure you're talking into the mic, though. Yes, I did read it. And I looked it up on Google, actually.
Okay. Before I talk about New York, I mean, I have to say this is my first trip to Cleveland. And are the people here nice or what? I mean, it's almost disconcerting. I think if I lived here, I wouldn't be able to write murder mysteries, because it's hard to find anybody who, you know, you despise enough to kill. But very interesting. But I grew up in Brooklyn. It is kind of the Brooklyn of old in my mind. Very easy way of life, very uncomplicated. As you mentioned, doors unlocked.
What part of Brooklyn did you grow up in?
It's a small space called Kensington. I don't know if you've heard of Kensington.
Yeah, I know where it is.
Near Ocean Parkway and 18th Avenue. And it was a kind of environment where kids got up in the morning. They went to went to school if they had to. We went to the playground. We played handball all day long and played basketball. And, you know, we came home, we absolutely had to come home. We were just, like, so into each other, and no pressure, not like today. Great way to break, to grow up. And my whole world was maybe 5-6 blocks long. You know, it was maybe, you know, from McDonald Avenue to 18th Avenue, which was 6 blocks in one direction, and from 18th Avenue to Ditmas Avenue, the other direction, which was 2 blocks. And I really had no need or no desire to go beyond that until I was about 19. And then all hell broke loose. But I had a good time growing up. My series takes place in Manhattan, but as with you, I live in Long Island now, so my protagonist is on the LIE a lot. I find there's, a good connection to take your killer from Lower Manhattan or from the streets of Manhattan and drag him out to the Pine Barrens, where there's, ample opportunity to bury somebody or hide something. And, my protagonist is always hunting down psychopaths. It's not simple killers. It's not a simple murder. It's always somebody who's a real head case. And I use every venue that I can.
Right. My next question is going to be about about your main characters. So you might as well just start with that. Your main character is Stephanie Chalice, who has a sixth sense. Right? Is that?
She does. And Stephanie Chalice, as Khan pointed out, it's written out as Chalice, She's of Italian descent. Her father's gone. Her father was also a policeman, but he's passed on. And she's got a very tight relationship with her mother, who's a very feisty old Italian. They're always arguing in the kitchen. You know, she's always cooking great food. And she's got a sixth sense, especially in the first book. She's got a lot of psychological baggage. She's having these nightmares, and she's waking up sweating and, you know, with tremors and heart palpitations. And these dreams are sort of a preamble to what's going on in the case. They sort of tie together. But she, you know, she too is, you know, a complex character, looking, you know, for psychological insights in everybody she interviews.
And so why did you pick that, or not pick, but where did she come from as a character? And
how did I invent Lisi? Here's a serious admission. I was a devout follower of Nelson DeMille and his John Corey character. And Nelson DeMille is really a very, very nice guy. He's one of the few, I shouldn't say that, he's one of the big names who actually is approachable. And we had corresponded a few times. And I said, you know, I really love your character. I'd love to do a female version of John Quarry. And he said, yeah, go for it, you know. And Stephanie Chalice is sort of a female John Quarry. Sharp-witted, a little feisty, a little quirky. And that was how that came together. I mean, in terms of her personality, it's just a composite of a lot of people I've known over the years. And I think many authors probably do that. You know, maybe not pick somebody as a whole, but you pick bits and pieces of people and you put them together.
You'd written books before the Stephanie Chalice, and did you have your main character as women then, or was this a...
No, the first character was definitely male.
All right, so... Wendy, Allison Taylor McKenna is... Mm-hmm. Living in Lower Manhattan at the time of the disaster at the World Trade Center. But she's not from New York, right?
She's not from New York. She's from a very small town in the Midwest, in Nebraska. I'm doing a 50-state, and I'm going 50-state book tour, and I was in Nebraska a few years ago on that leg of it, and was just struck by the openness of it, and that... Well, I can't, there's so many twists in here that I don't want to give away, but anyway, we're going to move back to that setting in the very, very end of the trilogy. Her past comes back to slam her head on. But she's a person who ran from the past. There's no better place to go if you want anonymity and a fresh start than New York. And when the first book opens in the trilogy, she's in her early 20s, she's working in the fashion industry. She's a little bit shallow and selfish, and you know, in the sense that 9/11, everybody was impacted by it in some way, she changes drastically, and you really get to see her grow up. By the second book, 10 years later, she's fallen in love, and she's married with 3 children. She's become a wife and mother. She's shed that shallow, vain, sort of self-absorbed piece of herself, but she's always been trying to bury something in the past, and it's going to come back. She falls in love with her neighbor, her across-the-hall neighbor. His name is Mac, and his wife is missing in the World Trade Center in the first book. And in the second book, they're married. He's widowed. And there's also a character. It's sort of there's a triangle here. The third character is Rocky Manzilla, this New York, he's an NYPD homicide cop. And I used a retired NYPD detective helped me with the research because I wanted it to be realistic, and it was really hard to find information online. As much as you think you remember, or there was information in the papers at the time, which I had, you know, there were so many specific little details, like where were you in, you know, on the day after? How did the cops move around? You know, how did the FBI get to New York? You know, all of these pieces had to come together, and he helped me with all of that.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to the research question, because all of you did some interesting sort of research, and I'm wondering how you did it. Mostly for me, actually. But Katja, Karen Schaefer is a former cop.
She's a former cop,
but she's never a cop in one of the books.
No,
right?
In the beginning of the it's a series with the fourth coming out this March. It's called The Money Kill. And the stories are, so the stories in each of the books are sort of standalone stories, unlike yours, which they all connect in an arc through the three. What connects through mine are mostly the characters, and
their lives that grow, and each book becomes a sort of a backstory for the next book, but not specifically in terms of the plot. So, in the first one, she's a 33-year-old retired detective from New Jersey who's living in Brooklyn, trying to escape her past and her life, because her husband and daughter have been killed by a serial killer who she was investigating. And in the opening scene, she learns that he's broken out of prison and he's coming for her because he kills whole families. So that book presents her as a suicidal former cop with nothing to lose, who first decides to let this guy kill her because that's really what she wants, and then in the middle of the conflict decides she really better stay alive and protect the rest of her family, her living family, and she begins to hunt him. So doing research for that, you know what my research would be? I love to read. In order to learn about detectives and cops and killers, my favorite thing is to read memoirs. Because, you know, aside from, you know, for the rules and regulations, I do turn to the internet a lot or go to visit a police station and speak with a detective. But for sort of the heart and soul of what it's like to be one of these people, I find that memoirs are really valuable. So, for the serial killer part of it, I read the book about, well, it was not a memoir, it was a biography, but about the BTK killer, because I wanted to read something.
About who?
BTK.
Right.
I wanted to read something, you know, like, you write fiction and you write about this stuff and you still can't understand or comprehend how a person can do these things. And of course, no book can reveal that. A nonfiction book can't reveal that, but it can show you what actually happened. So I learned a lot about how he operated and how he thought. And it still gives me shivers to think about that book. That was a tough one to read. And for my other books, you know, I have, like, for Vanishing Girls, for example, this book is really set in Brooklyn. It's, and a little bit in Manhattan. And there's a serial killer. So it looks like a serial killer novel, but it's really not. It's really a novel about human trafficking. So I wanted to take a very large issue and problem that's global. And I wanted, that we don't think of as being a New York problem per se, especially a kind of a small town type New York problem. And I wanted to take that global problem and make it very specific in a very small neighborhood in New York, and that's what I did, and cloaked it in a serial killer story. So to do research for that, I had to research human trafficking. And, you know, I really was just, I did it mostly on the internet. I read Half the Sky, which, if you haven't read it, is a book everybody should read. And that's not all about human trafficking, it's about third world women. But so I did a lot of reading just on that subject. And I found ways to integrate it into my very sort of more small town story.
Okay. And Meredith, you had in Lady Killer, I want to try to ask questions without giving away stuff in the book, and sometimes it's sort of hard. So tell me to stop if I start doing that. But you have a cop who's a major character, Dave Dillon, who's but you also have two social workers, you have a number of denizens of what they refer to as the underbelly of New York. So it's not, well, for by and large, Dillon is the main character, but there's also another cop, Jamie. But so your characters are a little bit different than the series kinds of characters. So where do they come from? You talked a little about that already.
Yeah, in my checkered career, I worked for a women's crisis center in Upper Manhattan for some time, mainly doing marketing and fundraising. But I also took their training and was a volunteer advocate, and we went into hospitals, especially at night, which is when sex crimes occur typically, and that's when the social workers at hospitals are off duty. So it was, you know, sort of they needed help in a way that it would be best if a social worker were there with them. But the alternative was to train civilians like me. And it was a very intense training, and we went into hospitals when there was a sex crime and stayed with the person until they were either admitted to the hospital or released, and made sure they got where they were going safely. And sometimes those were domestic violence victims, which is a whole other issue. But anyhow, I got to then I got to working for these people, and I got to know a lot of social workers very well, and I have, let me just say, a huge respect for people who deal with that pressure cooker situation that being a social worker in New York can be. But I also realized how crazy you could go if you were a social worker in New York, and mine has become a serial killer. Right? I, you know, it's like the first big surprise in the book, so I don't mind giving it away. I used to, like, carefully guard it, but you figure that out, I don't know, maybe a fourth of the way into the book, so it's not a big deal. But she is a female serial killer, and she is highly motivated. And I think it's what happens when people are in a helping profession and are overwhelmed, and they just snap. They just can't take it anymore. So that was kind of fun to write, because I got to pay back a bunch of annoying social workers. But the younger social worker is this woman's protege. So then the story becomes what happens to her when she realizes her mentor is a killer. So, you know, she's having a bad day.
It didn't do much for the goody-goody image of social workers. I have to say.
Yeah. It's got some issues.
But then your characters from the underbelly. So I never knew what an underbelly was. People referred to my first book as being about the underbelly of New York, and I'm saying that, you know, that's my neighborhood they're talking about.
Yeah, when I'm being polite, I call it the demi-monde, but yeah, it's definitely the underbelly. Well, I knew, you were talking about how there are layers to New York, and it is true, and 42nd Street still today has layers. If you walk along 42nd Street or go through Times Square or the spread out part of 42nd Street that Times Square leads to, you can, if you're really observant, you'll see that there are layers of things going on. There are the street hustlers and the criminals and the cops and the tourists and the residents and the legitimate people and the businessmen and the people who work there. And they're all passing each other at very close quarters. It's one of the most heavily trafficked streets in the world. For pedestrians and, God help us, vehicles. But people don't even see each other. The criminals do not see the tourists, except when, and usually, this is not, we're not talking about pickpockets, we're talking about drug trade and sex trade. So it's not really a tourist-driven thing anymore, because the cops patrol it pretty well for pickpockets and, you know, petty crime, and it's way too busy to get mugged anymore. There used to be stretches of 42nd Street where you wouldn't see a person at night for really a good while, and we took advantage of that in our book. But anyhow, 42nd Street has these layers, and if you are extremely observant, you can see what layer of society which people are in and who they're interacting with, even though they're among hundreds of people. It's a very interesting place. But how I know that, I don't know.
Just absorb it, yeah. I think. It's something you absorb by being there.
Well, in working at that crisis center, we saw every strata of society. We had people come in from New York's finest families, you know, beaten and raped, and we had people who were homeless, had been attacked by other homeless people. We saw everything, so it was a real education.
in each of the books, I learned a bunch of stuff, and I want to go into some of that. The first thing I want to ask about is police procedure, because all of the books had some of that. And I'm just wondering, and it's sort of a quick question, but I'm just wondering how you just make it up. Do you do ride-alongs? Do you marry a cop? I mean, how do you get your police procedure down? And why? Larry, why don't you start?
Well, I happen to grow up with a couple of friends who were very, very involved with NYPD in Brooklyn, both as regular policemen and involved with the SPCC.
And what's the SPCC?
Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. And I just spent a lot of time with them and learned a lot from them. When I have a question these days, I try to reach out to somebody who's actually on the job. And I do a lot of research online. But I do have I did assimilate a lot of background from my friends who were on the job back in my earlier days.
And Wendy, you started to talk about that before, but
yeah, I do a lot of research online, obviously, and I have a stack of books on police procedure and forensics and that kind of thing next to my desk. But I run into trouble when I like it to be realistic. I never just make it up, because readers will write you an email the next day that, you know, you got it wrong. But interestingly, with this, talking to this cop that I was put in touch with for this trilogy, I found out there were so many sort of layers there to the relationships between cops and cops' families and all of that, and in the boroughs. You know, my cop was in the Bronx, and then his best friend grew up to be an FBI profiler. I had created him for an earlier book a few years ago, and I brought him back, the profiler. But, he set me straight on things. Even just, we were having a conversation one day, and I was talking about, the firemen that were, that were lost in the World Trade Center, and then the cops. He was telling me about digging in the rubble alongside men who had lost their sons and sons who had lost their fathers. And because it is a family in New York, it's a family. Brothers are cops, and fathers and sons, and so it was very personal for them. And I was blown away by that. And this character, Rocky, from the first book, I just intended him to pop in and investigate. He became a major character because I was fascinated. But even just I said something one day, so you were, digging for your lost brothers, and he said, no, not our brothers. We don't say brothers. That's FDNY talk. We don't call each other brothers. And he sent me straight. And there were just little details like that he was very picky about. So I think it's authentic now, but I gave him the book, all three of the books to read.
Yeah, I thought that part about the everybody's connection to the disaster on 9/11 was authentic and really moving, because I mean, it certainly was the way it was in New York at that time. Katya, you're ex-cop and current cop in the book that
right.
I read.
Well, a lot of reading, internet interviews with detectives and cops, but also what I find is, book after book after book, I've written 10 crime novels, you get to really know it. And I have to do less research about procedure each time. And I read the paper a lot, so because I just like to. And I read every single article about any change in laws. And since I'm almost always writing about, and I mean, some of my earlier books are not set in New York, but, first of all, there's the federal laws, and then there are the state, and then there are the local laws. But I just try to keep up to date with it, and I research when I don't know. But again, it gets easier. You've written a zillion books, and isn't it?
Yeah, it becomes easier.
You just know. You just nature. You don't. It becomes second nature, so it's easier and easier. Less time consuming to do that research. Yeah.
Well, my husband, who co-wrote the novel Lady Killer with me, is a reporter, and he had covered crime. He's now a business journalist, but he had covered a lot of crime, so he knew a good bit about police procedure, and he knew cops. And I worked with a special squad when I was at the mayor's film office, the guys that protect film sites, and the city assigns them to film shoots in any public place for free.
in order to encourage filmmaking in New York. It's one of the services they provide. And those guys, a lot of them, it's considered a kind of a cushy assignment, and a lot of them, are old veterans who really deserve it. So I talked to the guys, and I got to know that whole squad. And then, I don't know, when you live in New York, somehow you just sort of run into cops. I got to know Sonny Grosso, a famous New York cop, very well. He was one of the original cops in the real French Connection case, the case that became the French Connection. And Sonny became a producer and did a couple cop series. I'm trying to think of what his series were, Con. Do you remember that?
No, I don't.
They had a bunch of, some of them were actually shot in Canada because they were always shooting on the cheap, and we would try to entice them back to New York, but Sonny was very helpful in all matters police and forensic. But yeah, I think, and then of course we all have the internet. Thank God. I don't know what we'd do without it. Yeah. Cops wouldn't have any time if we had to all do our research by talking.
And some precincts actually have really great websites with photographs of the interior of their precincts. And that is just invaluable. You can describe the color of the chairs. You know, you can describe where the clock is. I mean, it's fantastic. So I always hope that the precinct that I'm going to use has that.
Well, and at my crisis center, we used to go into the precincts to talk to cops at their morning or their shift change meetings and talk to them about sexual assaults and domestic violence, to encourage them to be a little more sensitive to the victims and, for one thing, not to call them victims. And so we met a certain amount of cops that way, and you get to see them, you know.
Right.
They're there, they're bored, they're irritated.
In their environment. And it's been a few years since I actually was in a precinct interviewing a detective, but at the end of it I said, you know, we're, you know, exchanging contact information, I could contact him anytime, he was great. Can I email you? And he laughed. And he's like, we don't have that here. So do they now? Your research is a little more recent.
He's
you know, they just, you know, it was so backward.
Yeah.
Real paperwork, actual paperwork.
You don't really see a cop on a BlackBerry very often.
No, they're just not doing that. They're not funded for that. Yeah.
Let me, I'm going to open it up to questions in one minute, but I have a couple of very specific questions. One is for Larry, the beach pneumatic transit.
Sure. In writing The Brain Vault, I had a very feral character. His name was Rat in the book, and I needed to create a lair for him. And, you know, as fiction writers, we make everything up. I mean, it's all just coming out of our heads. But I feel that, you know, you add, can add authenticity to the book by layering in some real facts. And the great thing about New York is that its history goes back to about, you know, the late 1500s. And it was built in strata. And as, you know, time progressed, layers were forgotten about or abandoned. And I needed a place in Lower Manhattan for this place to do, for this character to do his bidding or his evil work. And I came across the beach pneumatic subway system, which was actually built in 1870 and had all this great history. It was built and ran from Murray Street and ran under Broadway to Warren Street. And it was built during the time of Tammany Hall, which was a very corrupt administration. And they wouldn't give Alfred Eli Beach was the builder. He's actually also the founder of Scientific American. They wouldn't give him the funding or the permission to build this small subway. So he petitioned to do a mail air tube transport system, and they approved that. But because, you know, a subway is obviously a much bigger scale than a small tube for postage, he had to buy a store, and he surreptitiously carried out all the dirt and did all the excavation at night, pulling it all out in the dumpsters in the middle of the night, building this subway with anybody's knowledge. And so, you know, I thought it was, you know, really cool that I was able to, not that I was cool, but this fact was cool, that I was able to talk about this. It was really a grand subway. It had chandeliers and paintings and frescoes, and it was 25 cents, which was probably a fortune back in 1870. And people would go 300 feet from Warren Street to Murray Street, And that became the lair for this character.
It's only a couple of blocks from Otto Penzler's mysterious bookshop in Manhattan. All right, any questions? Who wants to answer?
He was asking about jurisdictions, whether there were jurisdictional disputes in among the boroughs in New York. But there, I don't know about that really. But there are jurisdictional disputes between the city and the state. The state is very jealous and guards its prerogatives, and you know holes up in Albany and drives us crazy. So no offense.
It's a great question.
Yeah, it is. But there were, one of the interesting things about Manhattan is that there are certain streets that you get to know, like, what was it? I think it's 84th Street. I might have this wrong now. I've sort of forgotten. But 84th Street on the west side, you'd see a lot of hookers. And back in the day when they were totally visible because everybody didn't wear hot pants. You'd think, why are they hanging out on the street? It's not as trafficked as 86th Street. It's not as far uptown as 96th Street. Why 84th Street? Because it's a precinct line. And if they saw a cop coming, they crossed the street. So things like that are just, you know, rife.
You know, one of the jurisdictional disputes was between the fire department and the police department over their amphibian. You know, they both have boats, and they were fighting over stuff in their East River. I don't remember what that was. Sorry.
No, I was just saying, I think it's precinct to precinct. That's always been my understanding. Yeah,
and when I revisited this crime, and it's in Westchester, I had to find out why they would bring in these cops from, you know, the New York homicide detectives. It would be because it was a similar signature, and it was obviously the same killer, and they sort of, you know, but I kind of fudged that a little bit because he said, oh, there would be certain procedure you'd have to follow, and I thought, I need this to happen, so it's going to happen.
Are there other questions? Another question? Yes. The question is how do police, detectives, and whatever respond if you as a mystery writer go to ask them questions?
I agree. I also feel like I don't want to take their time. But what each precinct has is a public information officer, and you start with them. And that's what they're there for. So the time I got to spend at least 30 or 45 minutes one-on-one interviewing a detective was when I had made an appointment and gone to meet the public information officer, and he was very forthcoming. And he at one point just didn't know some answers, and he ran, I think, upstairs and brought me a detective. And the guy was great, and he spent time with me. So he didn't have to come down to talk to me. He came by choice. And then when I was done, I acknowledged them in my book, and I sent over copies. I don't know if they remembered who I was or why the books were, you know, arriving to them, but I wanted to do that. But I'm always very conscious of that too, and it would be great if, you could, without any sense of, impinging on their valuable time, call them constantly. But yeah, public information officers is the place to start.
To go through it, the proper procedure to get in touch with them. You don't walk up to a beat cop and say, you know, hey, if I were going to murder somebody, you know, but there are, you send an email with your credentials or whatever, and they're usually, they'll put you through to the right people.
Right.
You don't just, like, basically pick up the phone and call the precinct.
Yeah, some of them are very forthcoming. Sometimes you talk to a cop and say, really, you want to put my stuff in a book? Is there going to be a movie?
They like that.
Also Lee Laughlin's Police Academy for people who are interested in getting in touch with cops. I think that would be probably an easy place to have those kind of conversations. We're getting close to the end, I think. Is somebody a timekeeper here? Not according to my clock, which is the official clock. Can everybody just mention your next book or your latest book, and so people don't forget, and then we can stop?
Okay, sure. My newest book, and as we mentioned, it just came out. It's called Our Honored Dead, which is a little bit of a mouthful. It's the fourth book in the series with my female detective, Stephanie Chalisi. A couple of big twists in this book. She's evolved a lot as a character over these four books. And this book, she's actually pregnant and dealing with solving a case and maternity and hunger pangs and daydreams and, you know, dealing with all these physical symptoms at the same time. So I think it'd be an interesting twist, and I hope people will like it.
Like I said, Night Watcher was out in September, and then there's a twist on the very last page. If you thought you knew who did it, who done it all the way through, it's a really big twist at the end, and that opens the door to Sleepwalker, which just came out last week. That's an October release, and then Shadow Killer wraps it up. It's going on sale January 29th. So this is the whole trilogy right here.
And for me, Vanishing Girls came out in June. It's the third in my series, as I mentioned. And the fourth in the series coming out at the end of March is called The Money Kill. And it's a different kind of novel. It's about greed and a case that looks like one thing and is really another. And the family, which was expanded as a result of events in Vanishing Girls, ends up traveling from New York to London and ultimately Sardinia, an island in Italy, where a lot of the action takes place. So that's the end of March.
Well, I'm the world's slowest writer, and I've just finally finished a book I've been working on for 3.5 years, so I'm hoping it will be out soon. It's called Hellmouth. I don't actually have a publisher yet, but we're looking.
What's it called?
Hellmouth.
Hell?
Hellmouth.
Hellmouth.
Which is both main character's nickname and also it's a mine, a coal mine.
Okay, and my next book is coming from Thomas Dunn's Minotaur sometime after I finish it, which I hope will be very soon. All right, thank you all very much for coming.